Doc followed the others out of the caves and back toward the ville. The sun was just starting to dip below the fringe of trees. Everyone was carrying their bounty. Doc was starting to get hungry, but he knew he'd never be that hungry. All around him, his friends and the Rousties were talking, but not to one another. They spoke only to themselves or their imaginary friends. Each was wrapped up in his or her own world.
Like inmates at the asylum.
The zombies deposited their wormy prizes on the ground beside the already roaring drum fire. The rumbling grew steadily louder and louder. Doc could feel the storm's intensity building. In a matter of minutes, a bank of churning clouds appeared above the ville. Darkness descended. There was no lightning, but there was a blistering wind and snow. Sideways sheets of yellow snow as fine as table salt swept down the mountain and over the square. It was dry, but not cold. It stung Doc's face. He hunched his shoulders and turned his back to it. The others made no concessions to the strange downpour. They leaned against the driving wind and let it hit them straight on. Then the clouds dropped lower and grew thicker. The snow came down like a blizzard. It became difficult to breathe. Tanner was forced to take refuge in one of the nearby lean-tos, crawling on elbows and knees over the dirt floor. Outside, the storm crescendoed. The winds whipped the tattered plastic sheeting and crudely lashed cross members above Doc's head, threatening to flatten the flimsy structure. It shook the ground beneath him. Then, as quickly as it began, it was over. The thunder stopped, the snowfall stopped, the darkness lifted. When he crawled out of the hut, he saw a clear turquoise sky and the sun dipping below the tree line. The square was peopled with living statues, everything dusted with pale yellow. All around him, the snowdrifts were visibly shrinking. He bent and scooped up some in his hand. It wasn't made of flakes, but individual grains, like pollen or crystals. In seconds, the stuff began melting in his palm. Doc dumped what was left of the snow on the ground and brushed off his hands. Moments later, he began to notice a tingling numbness in his fingers and feet. It spread rapidly to his mouth and lips. He clenched his fists, heart pounding under his chin, as he anticipated being turned to stone like the others. But the numbing sensation didn't travel any farther. He quickly rubbed the circulation back into his hands and face. He hurried across the square, walking between the rigidly upright human forms. The snowfall had produced immediate and total paralysis in every other person present. Even the Baron, the Black Man, and the three who'd come out of the Baja Bug. When Doc reached Ryan, he laid his hand on his friend's chest. The one-eyed man was barely breathing. His heartbeat was very slow. His pupil was dilated, and its blink reflex was stifled. Doc took hold of Carter's arm and shook him.
"Ryan, my dear boy, wake yourself. You are bewitched."
Nothing. No response. It was the same with all the companions. He couldn't rouse them from their stupor. After a few minutes passed, the paralysis started to wear off. Gradually, everyone began to stir. As they regained their faculties, there was a noticeable change in their behavior. They were all quiet, tranquil, and smiling. Whatever was influencing them had reestablished complete control. The evidence so far pointed to some chemical in the snow. Doc reflected on what the Baron had said about the pool being the source of everything here. He had an idea that a complex living system was in operation. Its size, power, and menace were almost tangible. If it existed as a single entity, it was the largest creature Doc had ever encountered. If the tendrils were fungal, as Doc had speculated, then the snow would be fungal spores. If they were vegetable, the snow would be plant pollen. Either way, they were the entity's genetic material. Doc could recall no sign of anything growing in, on, or around the pool. That didn't mean much. Fungi and plants could be living in profusion on the pool's bottom. Because fungi were such simple structures and tended to grow so closely together, it was sometimes difficult to separate one individual form from others of the same type in the same area. Whether it was one gigantic creature or an entire population, the danger was palpable. Doc asked himself why he hadn't been paralyzed by the spore fall. Was it because he was already stark raving mad when exposed to the stuff? It seemed to have had the opposite effect on him as it had on the others. It had straightened him out. And the spores had only brought a mild numbness to his hands, feet, and face. Perhaps he was immune. Perhaps that immunity had something to do with his time travel, with the rearrangement of his atomic structure. Perhaps everyone else's susceptibility had to do with Skydark-produced mutations, mutations that he didn't have. None of these speculations satisfied him, especially since Mildred was also pre-Skydark, and she had been affected. As the others turned to face the Baron, Doc moved to the back of the crowd.
"Bring out the chair!"
Two of his men pulled a metal office armchair out into the middle of the square. A third man placed a long pipe with a rag-wrapped handle in a four-wheeled cart and pushed it near the chair. Everyone pressed in closer until they were shoulder to shoulder, ringing the center of the square. They seemed expectant and eager, all wearing stiff, unnatural grins on their faces.
"Azimuth, come here, please."
"Be right there."
"See, people, the burning pool is hungry, and we must feed it as it feeds us. Eat the body, become the body.
Eat the body, become the body. Eat the body, become the body.
By the three Kennedys, even you, dear Jack."
"This evening we celebrate three departures. The road to where these fortunate souls are going starts right here."
Kerr patted the back of the chair.
"Who's going to be first to take the load off?"
A shoving match erupted between the three men to see who'd take the seat. The pushing escalated into full-power punches and kicks. When one of the men fought his way to the chair, the other stopped wrestling and quickly strapped down his wrists and ankles. The winner smiled as this was happening, showing his bloody teeth to the crowd. The man in dreadlocks took the iron pipe from the cart and made a whistling practice swing. Overhead and down, he drove the end of the pipe into the dirt. Doc watched as the cook then moved to the back of the chair. Planting his feet, he reared back on one leg and swung the pipe over and down, putting all his weight behind the blow. Like pounding in a tent stake with a 20-pound mallet. At the last second, Doc averted his gaze, but he didn't have time to stop up his ears. He heard the hollow whack of the pipe and the sound of crunching bone. Dean, who stood next to him, flinched at what he saw, but didn't look away.
"This simply cannot be real."
But when the old man looked back, the seated man's head was caved in, his body jerking and kicking against the restraints. Tenor's stomach heaved mightily. He was going to be sick. The others were just standing there, staring at the horror, smiling. It was like they were seeing something completely different than he was. Doc was still bent over, dry heaving, when one of the two remaining men pulled the body out of the seat and dumped it into the waiting cart. The third man took the opportunity to slip past the other and sit in the chair, firmly gripping the arms and wrapping his shins around the front legs. When the second man couldn't drag him out of the seat, he buckled down the wrist and ankle straps. The man in the chair beamed at the audience as though he were about to be crowned king of the world, instead of being simply crowned. As Ryan made his way out of the caves, the entourage of people from his past trooped alongside him. Their happy chatter began to fade as he approached the exit. When he turned to look at Trader and his father, he saw their shapes rippling, then disintegrating like smoke in the breeze. A terrible sadness struck him. He didn't want them to go, but he couldn't make them stay. Outside the cave, Ryan the passenger became Ryan the captain, the sole commander of his own body. Fully conscious as he walked toward the square, he understood that he'd been hallucinating and was being held against his will, made to perform like a puppet or a muti in the zoo. Christy, J.B., Mildred, Jack, and Dean stumbled along, lost in their own inner worlds, raving to themselves. Something terrible had gripped them all, and it was toying with them. Ryan knew he had to gather Dean and the others and get out of there while the getting was good. Even as he shook free of the leadenness that still hung upon his limbs, thunder boomed at his back. Then came the hot wind and the sting of the pale yellow snow. He stopped walking and turned to face it. The initial jolt this time, the plunge into the perfume of the flower fields, was less shocking to his system. He slid into it like a well-worn pair of boots. Almost at once, he had a profound sense of well-being. All the doubts were smoothed away. He stood there, eyes shut, head tilted back, mouth wide open, letting the spores fall on his tongue. They tasted like sugar. Trader and his father, Baron Titus, were by his side again. Passenger Ryan knew this couldn't be. But the body in which he was trapped felt their presence, their physical warmth. It even smelled Trader's cigar smoke. When everyone moved in close to the chair, Ryan's body moved along too. When they grinned enchanted, it grinned enchanted. In all his days, Ryan had never seen men fight each other to be the first to die. Passenger Ryan felt the body rejoice at the sight of them and was disgusted. Not only did he have no control over his emotions, but they weren't even his emotions. He wanted to look at the others, but he couldn't make his head turn. Ryan sensed that his friends were feeling the same way as he, that they were smiling like he was. The insanity was like an infection. And yet, none of them could break free and stop the horror. The man strapped in the chair was filthy and raggedy, beard matted. His eyes burned like blue coals in his head. He was missing most of his front teeth. It was hard to guess his age, but he was probably somewhere between 20 and 30. It all happened very quickly. Azimuth stepped behind the chair, cocked, then brought down more than a yard of metal pipe. The impact drove the man's head between his shoulders. His skull crunched lopsidedly. Brains flew, blood sprayed. His right eyeball popped out of its socket and dangled on his cheek. From the cratering wound, twinkling points of light streamed upward, circling maybe 5 feet above the body, building in volume and turbulence. The light continued to stream until the corpse heaved its last jerk. Then the pinpoints drifted farther and farther apart until they finally disappeared. Ryan, the passenger, was stunned by the detail and realism. Had it been a hallucination? Or had he witnessed the spirit flowing out of the dying body, the soul freed? After dumping the corpse in the cart, the two men left squabbled and struggled over who'd take the seat next. The guy who won was strapped down by the other one. The lucky winner glanced over his shoulder at the waiting black man, a gleeful expression on his face. Then he turned back and shut his eyes like he was in store for a pleasant surprise. The black man swung the pipe down again. Ryan was jolted to the core, as if he'd been the one who'd been struck. And again he witnessed the streaming non-substance of ectoplasm, of soul.
Traitor whispered in Ryan's ear,
"This is the real Carney.